Imagine the scene. Three heads in silhouette. An intense piece by Mozart strikes up in the background. Minor key. Sensing an intense encounter to come. And words flash over the screen. The epilogue. A question of belief. And then the lights come up upon the presenter sitting in the middle and the two guests on either side of him. The guest says, "Good evening and welcome to the epilogue. Tonight on the program, to my right, Monsignor Edward Degay, a theologian and lecturer at Somerset Theological College, an author of several books on belief, most recently the bestseller, My God. To my left, Dr. Tom Jack, humanist, philosopher, and author of books such as the bestseller, Hello Sailor. Tonight, on the epilogue, instead of having our usual discussion about the existence or non-existence of God, they're going to fight for it. The match being determined by two falls, two submissions, or a knockdown. And instantly behind them, a wrestling ring appears. And the announcer hands over to the wrestling announcer, who introduced the two contestants, and the humanist philosophy professor and the Catholic Monsignor go at it. And then the announcer comes back and he says, "We will be presenting the results of this discussion later in the program." Monty Python has a way of converging seemingly disparate ideas into satirical and existential and absurdist humor. By the way, over the closing credits, the voice comes back on. Here are the results of the epilogue. God exists by two falls to a submission. Jacob. His name literally means one who deceives. Manipulator. Even heel grabber. Because when he was coming out of the womb right after his twin brother Esau, he was grabbing onto Esau's heel. Jacob knew how to trick people. He tricked his brother out of his birthright for a bowl of stew. He tricked his father, Isaac, out of said birthright right under his nose. He eventually tricked his future father-in-law, Laban, out of most of his flocks and herds. Jacob was a manipulator. And he was also the victim of manipulation. Parental favoritism. Isaac preferred Esau. Rebekah, his mother, preferred him, which led her to at times manipulate him into doing things that she wanted him to do, like steal Esau's birthright from him. Jacob also had to endure hardships, like being tricked himself by Laban into working for over 20 years just to finally win the hand of the woman that he loved. You know, we're formed as people not just by decisions we make and actions we take. And it's not just how we're hardwired, our DNA. It's also things that happen around us and even to us. And Jacob is no different than us on this account. He is possibly the most effective ancient used car salesman we've ever seen. He is a deceiver, and at the same time, he's also been manipulated and deceived. And at the same time, he became a self-made man. He used that knack and that skill to be able to provide eventually for his own family and make his way in life against the odds. And for most of his adult life, he's been on the run because of stealing that birthright. The last conversation he had with his brother Esau was a death threat from Esau. If I see you again, curtains. So Jacob flees, and it's been over 2 decades since he's seen his brother. And he now has a family and an entourage. And as he's headed back in the direction towards his original home, he knows he's going to encounter his brother. And he's scared. So what does he do? The self-made man kicks into action. The manipulator. And he starts trying to control the circumstances as much as he can. And so he sends ahead of him his herds and his flocks and his servants. He sends on ahead of him down the road even his wives and his children, his family. So when Esau meets them on the road, he'll see that he does have a family, that he has people he loves and cares about, and that he's made a life for himself. This leaves Jacob all alone on the other side of the Jabbok River. And what happens? The epilogue, a question of belief in 3 rounds. Jacob enters a wrestling match. And Jacob, in his own way, has been a fighter, a wrestler, his whole life. But this opponent is different. And our scriptures don't really give us an entirely clear idea who this wrestling match opponent actually is. And scholars have taken a stab at a lot of different interpretations. Is this his brother Esau coming to him in the night to finally have it out with him? Is it some kind of angelic being from the heavens beyond that's manifest with superhuman strength? Is it some sort of pre-existent appearance of Jesus, the presence of God in mysterious form? Is it Jacob himself that he's actually having a physical and existential wrestling match with his own being? We don't know. All that we know is that it's a doozy of a match and it goes all night. And as you read and we hear this story, we get the sense, knowing Jacob's story leading up to this, that this really has been what his life has been leading up to. The wrestling and fighting that's gone on externally is really just a manifestation of a wrestling that's been internal. Well, now it has a chance for expression. And Jacob finally faces up to who and what has been eating away at him his whole life. And maybe for the first time in his life, he's honest with himself. He's honest with his Creator. He finds himself, rather than manipulating that Creator, clinging on to whatever manifestation of that Creator this man is. And what we learn is that through the experience, Jacob encounters the presence of God. That Hebrew word, presence, can also be face. Jacob comes, in that sense, face to face with God. And really with himself, his truest self. And what's the result? He's transformed. He's given a new name. No longer deceiver, but now wrestler. Or one who wrestles with God. Israel. He's given a new vision of his identity. He's exposed to his deepest, truest identity through the wrestling. He's also given a limp. He has a physical, tangible, daily, constant reminder that because God is who God is, and He is who He is, He doesn't have to try and manipulate circumstances or manipulate the Creator to make sure that life somehow goes His way. He can trust that that life, that strength, that power, those gifts and abilities come from a place that's far beyond Him. And that ultimately, He doesn't have control. And that's a blessing for Him to realize this. You know, there's a lot of pain in our world. We don't have to listen to the news to experience it. There's a lot of anger being hurled in every direction in our world, in our nation, in our culture. A lot of questions rumbling in our public discourse, in our private thoughts and feelings. Why are so many innocent people losing their lives, or their livelihoods, or their homes, or their families? Why won't our leaders stop fueling the fires of divisiveness and division and do something about this? Bring us together. Help us find our common core of unity as human beings, as children of God. Why won't God do something about the mess that we're in? There's questions and frustrations that have been rumbling around in my head for years. Why does it seem that those who are nearest and dearest to us have to face such hellish and daunting struggles in life? Why do we have to encounter such tragedies? Whether it be the loss of a loved one, or the loss of a relationship, or the loss of a job, or the loss of a dream, or the loss of hope. Why do our children have to face seemingly innumerable challenges in a world that seems to be growing crazier by the day? Why is our future as a species still so unclear? Not just around the globe, and not just in our nation, but right here in our city, right here in our own community, our own neighborhood. Why do we have to live with so much uncertainty? You know, our pain, our frustration, our anger at recognizing these realities in our world can really do one of two things. It can become a wall that we erect between ourselves and our Creator, between ourselves one to another, between ourselves and our deepest self. And those questions, those anxieties, those frustrations can become grenades that we launch over the wall towards those we disagree with, those we blame for the hardships in our world, even when the one we blame is we ourselves. Or our pain and anger can become a way of engaging personally with God, with each other, with ourselves. And the questions, the frustrations can become catalysts for wrestling. Wrestling and being honest about what's going on inside of us, being honest about what's going on in our community and in our nation and in our world. And maybe that wrestling can become a pathway towards blessing, even healing. If there's one thing we learn from Jacob's story, is that often in our lives, pain is the pathway to blessing. And that's hard to embrace when you live in a culture whose cardinal virtue seemingly is the elimination of pain at all costs. Jacob shows us that when we finally get driven to a point where we have maybe even no other choice but to embrace our pain and wrestle with it, that something deeper and truer and more redemptive and more life-giving can emerge out of it. And whether it's Jacob at the Jabbok or Jesus in the garden, this reality repeats itself and reveals itself in ways as unique and individual as each and every one of us. Imagine the picture. Jacob limping towards the breaking dawn at the end of that match. No longer Jacob, but Israel. Imagine the picture of Jesus staggering out of the tomb and towards another breaking dawn. His brokenness revealing our blessedness. Their exhaustion meeting exhilaration and reanimation and becoming a divine dance of celebration and transformation. God exists. I don't know if it's by two falls to a submission, but we do know that it's in the wrestling that we rediscover our wonder and gain wisdom and maybe even find hope. Amen.